Morning. I'm going to see if I can fix this thing a little bit better. All right. Well, we started a tradition here at Cornerstone a few years ago that at the beginning of every year, we take some time to look back over the past year and to look at some things that that took place, to kind of reflect on the things that we've been talking about as a church, and also we're a church that does slideshows. And so at the end of the service, we've got a slideshow that we're going to look at with some highlights from this past year. Sue did that this week. I really appreciate the work she put into it. And but we're going to reflect on our theme for 2014, which was known, which is not up on the wall anymore. So I had to put it in my notes here. when my daughter Julia was a preschooler, she liked to help me work on things, which is great because it seems like around our house there's always things that need working on. She loved to help. I loved to have her around because, you know, one, she's just cute. But also, she applauds. Change a light bulb, you get applause. Unclog a drain, you get applause. That's pretty awesome. I was watching a concert on TV a while back, and the guy on stage, you know, everybody applauded after a song, and he said, you know, I think everybody ought to have a job where people just applaud every about 3.5 minutes. And, you know, not many of us have jobs like that. How many of you have a job where people just give you applause on a regular basis? Only Phil Dawson. You know, not all of us can work in the exciting and entertaining field of accounting. But one time on a trip to Home Depot when Julia was about 5 years old, she said, Daddy, why do you have so many tools? And I said, because so many things need fixing. And she said, well, can you be a builder? And I said, well, I like to build things, especially build things out of wood, but the truth is I'm way too slow to make a living at it. So I just do it for fun. And she said, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? Already at 5 years old, she just knew some things about me, you know. She said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And don't say a daddy because you're already a daddy. I'm talking about a builder or a doctor or a painter or an artist or a king. And I thought, there's several choices there, and one's kind of standing out to me a little bit. But then she said, I want to be a queen. I want to be a queen who enjoys watching TV and playing in my room. And I thought, that's a pretty remarkable vision for a five-year-old to think, I want to be a queen, not only a queen, but one who is known for watching TV and playing in my room. But that fall, Julia started first grade, and at the beginning of first grade, like, you know, in the early grades, they do those get-to-know-me exercises, you know, where you have to fill in the blank. And it said, when I grow up, I want to be, and she put, a queen. And, you know, I thought, that would require some fairly remarkable changes. Radically different form of government. Different way of a national identity, the way of thinking about ourselves, everything, you know, would have to change. What would it take for Julia to be queen of Atlanta or queen of the United States? I don't know. You know, we don't usually think in terms of things changing that radically, but, you know, maybe we ought to think like that more often. But it's good to have clear goals and a clear vision of who you are or who you want to become. And that's really what this theme of known is about. You know, we talked about, we've got a slide here. Boom. There's a graphic we used on our website and at the beginning of the year when we talked about different aspects of known. We talked about our security, our identity, and our legacy. And I'll talk for a few minutes about those things. And the sermons throughout the whole year, I've focused in some way about these aspects of knowing and being known. And at the beginning of the year, I talked about Jesus' encounter in John chapter 4 with the Samaritan woman. And, you know, this woman's life was a mess. Her theology was way off. She was a social outcast. Yet there was something about her that she connected with Jesus in a way that even the 12 apostles didn't connect with him at that point. She had this conversation with Jesus. And she left that conversation with Jesus and went back to the town where she was from. And in the time it took the 12 apostles to figure out what was for supper, she brought a whole town to Jesus. She connected with Jesus' purpose and his mission of sharing the good news of the kingdom with other people in a deeper way than the 12 apostles did. And she had a number of questions for Jesus, and she even, you know, and she got things wrong. He said, "I'm living water." She says, "Give me some of that water so I won't have to keep coming to the well to get water." And she didn't quite have it right, but there was something about it. Her testimony to the town when she went back, she said, "Come see a man who told me everything I ever did." And she said that like it was a good thing. "Come see a man who told me everything I ever did." Everything changed for her. It clicked with her when she realized that she was fully known and fully loved. And none of us share her exact same life circumstances, but I believe we share this. In the core of our souls, we all long to be fully known and fully loved. And a part of the good news, the gospel, is that with God, we are fully known and fully loved. God knows everything about us. He could tell us everything that we've ever done, and he still loves us. And when that Samaritan woman figured it out, everything changed. And this is something we've tried to focus on this year, is understanding that we are all fully known and fully loved by God. That is our security. We spent some time in John chapter 1 looking at Jesus' encounter with this skeptical man named Nathanael. And Philip, one of the 12, was really excited when he met Jesus. And the first thing he did is he went and got Nathanael and brought Nathanael to Jesus. But Nathanael didn't seem to be quite so excited. He was skeptical. He said, "Come and see, you know, Jesus from Nazareth." Nathanael's response was, "Nazareth? Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Then Jesus talks with him. And he says in verse 47 of John 1, he says, "Here is a true Israelite in whom there is nothing false." Here's a true son of Israel who's not a deceiver. He makes this connection as he's talking with Nathanael to Jacob or Israel, the father of the nation of Israel. And he says, "You're a true son of Israel, not a deceiver. There's nothing false in you." You know, the name Jacob means deceiver, and God changed his name to Israel, which means struggles with God. And so here's this man who was skeptical, who wasn't believing that Jesus was the Messiah the way that Philip seemed to believe it. And he has this amazing encounter with Jesus. And then Jesus makes another reference to Jacob as well in verse 50. He says, you know, you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree before we actually met. He says, but you are going to see greater things than these. I tell you the truth, you're going to see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. And here he's referring to Jacob's dream at Bethel. Jacob was on the run from his brother Esau, and he has this dream in this place. It just says in a certain place, which is a way of saying no place in particular. Is near a town that was called Luz, and he has this dream, and he sees angels ascending and descending a ladder or a staircase. And when he wakes up, he says, surely the Lord was in this place, and I didn't know it. And he named that place Bethel, which means house of God. He said, I didn't know it, but this is a place where there's a connection between heaven and earth. And Jesus refers to that story, and he says, I tell you the truth, yeah, I knew who you were before I talked to you. I saw you under the fig tree before we met, but you're going to see greater things than that. I tell you the truth, you're going to see heaven open, and you're going to see angels ascending and descending, not on a ladder, but on me. You're going to figure out that I'm a place where there's a connection between heaven and earth. You're going to figure out that the Lord is here even though you didn't know it. And right now, you may be having doubts. You may be struggling with your skepticism. But you're going to believe. And he connected him with this heritage, with this identity of Israel as being one who's a seeker of truth and one who wrestles with God even through doubts and through trials and through struggles. And Nathanael went on to become a disciple of Jesus. And I think he really did say, surely this is the Lord, and I didn't know it. But Jesus, by referring to the story of Jacob, connected him with an identity, a heritage of faith that fights through doubt. And he went on to deeper faith by living into that identity through walking with Jesus. And it all began with Jesus telling him who he was. It all began with Jesus giving him an identity. And that made all the difference. So we talked about our security, known by God, fully known and fully loved. And then we talked about the identity, who we're known as, by God and by ourselves. And then we talked about our legacy, what we're known for. Turn over to John chapter 13. We're not going to take time to read the whole account here, but this is Jesus' last encounter with all of his followers before his arrest. They're observing Passover together, what's kind of famously called the Last Supper. And in the sitting, Jesus gets up, wraps a towel around his waist, and washes their feet. So here's Jesus, their Lord and teacher, undressed, on his knees, lovingly touching them, washing them where they're the dirtiest, where they need it the most. And in the middle of this setting, Jesus lets them know that one of them is going to betray him. It becomes clear that it's Judas, and Judas leaves to go betray him to the religious leaders. And when Judas was gone, Jesus says, "Now is the Son of Man glorified." As he takes the role, takes the duty of a servant in washing their feet, and as one of his 12 closest leaves to go betray him, he says, "Now I'm glorified." And in the middle of this setting, in verse 34, Jesus says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." This is what you will be known for. This is your legacy. When people see you, they see what you do. They see what you practice. They will know that you're my follower because you love like I love. You know, and what did he mean by that? How did Jesus demonstrate his love? Well, maybe in thousands of ways, but right here in this context, the way he demonstrated it was by serving them, by meeting a need. You know, verse 1 of chapter 13 says, "Having loved those who were in this world, he now showed them the full extent of his love." He showed them how far he was willing to go in washing their feet, and then going on to be arrested and to be crucified. In Luke 22 and elsewhere, you know, Jesus says, "The greatest among you will be your servant." You know, I don't believe Jesus was throwing that out as a challenge just to see if they were really committed. Although it can be challenging to be a servant. But when Jesus said, "The greatest among you will be a servant," he was just speaking the truth. Who are the greatest people in your life? Isn't it those who care for you, who take care of you, who love you, who help you with the things that you need the most? You know, the world views greatness in so many different ways. You know, accomplishments. I mean, you know, I can't tell you who won the gold medal in ski jumping last Winter Olympics. There may be some really, really big ski jumping fans in here who could tell you. But most of us, you know, you did this pretty amazing accomplishments, but then you're forgotten like that. But I tell you who you don't forget. And that's people who took care of you when you were in need. Those are the greatest people in our lives, the greatest people in our hearts. The greatest people in the world are those who serve us. And then Jesus goes on to say, chapter 14, verse 1, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going." So another way that Jesus served and loved and cared for these people is at the moment, possibly his moment of greatest need, when Judas has already gone to betray him and he knows what's ahead. He knows what he's about to face with being handed over. He's going to be tried in a mock trial. He's going to be beaten. And ultimately, he's going to be crucified. And in that moment, his greatest moment of need, what's on Jesus' heart is that his followers don't get discouraged because of what he's going through. He says, "Don't let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me." you know, they got together this last time and were observing the Passover. And as part of the Passover tradition, one of the things that would have happened with Jesus being at the head of the table, he would have served them a glass of wine. Actually, four different glasses of wine. But at the end, there was a cup that was given to them. And then Jesus says these words. But in the first century, in this culture, there was another tradition at a gathering like this. It's what's called the wedding feast, but it's what we think of as engagement. There would be a big feast, and there would be a groom-to-be and a bride-to-be. All the families would gather, and one of the customs in that gathering of the wedding feast, or this engagement feast, as we would call it, is the groom-to-be offers the bride a glass of wine. And she can actually accept it or not. And I would say that if she ever didn't accept it, it means the guy has not done his homework. Because you don't want that to happen in front of everybody. But there, you know, it's kind of this moment. I imagine there's some tension, some pressure. He's offering the wine. Does she take it? Yes. Okay, good. We can continue with our party here. If she says yes, then he gives this prepared speech. And then what happens after that is the bride-to-be continues living with her parents, and she's learning how to effectively manage a household. And what the groom-to-be does then after this wedding feast is he goes back to his father's house. And in those days, you know, generations could live together in the same place. And what would happen when a young man was going to get married, he would go to his father's house and then he would build a room onto the existing house. And that's one of the things he would do after the wedding feast. He would go back to his father's house and build another room. And while his wife's learning how to manage, his wife-to-be is learning how to manage a household, he's building the place where they're going to live. And I guess he knows it's time for them to actually have the wedding ceremony when he finishes building the room onto his father's house. And so there's this time of waiting as they're both preparing for their life together. But it starts with a cup of wine that's offered and accepted, and then a speech is given, and the speech goes something like this. In my father's house are many rooms. I'm going back to prepare a place for you, and then I'm going to come and get you and take you that you can be with me there. And in this moment when Jesus is serving them, washing their feet, laying down his life for them, giving them the command to go and love other people the way that he's loved them, he offers them a cup of wine and he says, I'm going away. Where I'm going, you can't come, but trust me. Trust God, trust also in me. What I'm doing is I'm going to prepare a place for you, and I will come back and take you to be with me. And Jesus went to prepare a place for them, and a place for you, and a place for me. And in the meantime, we are here learning how to manage a household. We're here learning to love other people the way that Jesus loved. Looking forward to the day when he comes to take us. But he gives them something to do. He says, here's what you're to do in the meantime. Love each other the way that I've loved you. And he says, by this, all men will know that you're my disciples if you love each other. By this, everyone will know. This will be your legacy. This is what you're known for. You know, legacy is not something you dabble in. Legacy is not what you do for a couple hours on Sunday. Legacy is something you're devoted to. Legacy is about what you practice. Loving as Jesus loved, showing yourself to be his disciple. It's what becomes embedded in your character through practice. You might say it's what you're married to. You know, this year, as we focused on this theme of known, my prayer is that who we are from God's perspective has become more firmly imprinted in our minds and our hearts. I hope that by what we focused on this past year, we've become more confident in the fact that we are all fully known and fully loved by God. Through our focus this year, I pray that we're more confident in our identity as children of God. And my prayer is that our actions, all we do, has come to flow more naturally from who we are. Because I believe that all we do, the practices that we sustain over time flow from who we are. It's not just a checklist. It's not a list of obligations, something we have to do, that we have to gut it out and just grind our teeth and do it, but it's something that flows from who we are. And just like the Samaritan woman or Nathaniel or the 12, that they understood and they accepted who they were from God's perspective. You know, in Jeremiah chapter 9, 23 and 24, it says, "This is what the Lord says, let not the wise man boast of his wisdom, or the strong man boast of his strength, or the rich man boast of his riches, but let him who boasts boast about this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who exercises kindness, justice, and righteousness on earth, for in these I delight, declares the Lord." Let's take a few moments now to reflect on the things that we've done together in 2014 as we focused on our security, our identity, and our legacy in God. Thank you.